listening to Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you to the people and the places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chitakis. Crenshaw Boulevard was packed this past Saturday.
Good evening, good afternoon. Are you out there? Hello, hello, hello. There you are. This is a celebration. You are here.
This, by the way, is Destination Crenshaw, a 1.3-mile-long art park. It's being created by African-American artists, architects, designers, community activists, and elected officials. And on Saturday, shiny shovels went into the ground to mark the start of construction. And there was plenty of partying, including a tribute to the late Nipsey Hussle and a song honoring the district itself.
Some things will never, never change.
KCRW's Frances Anderton was at that celebration over the weekend. She's here now to tell us more about what's called Destination Crenshaw and how the project is playing into fears about gentrification in that area. Frances, hello.
Hello, Steve.
So this was a big groundbreaking. What was it like over there?
Well, it was a party, as you could hear. Lots and lots of people joined. Officials say there was around 2,000 people showed up. There were bands and speeches. You heard from the Inglewood Marching Band, Issa Rae, Alex Isley. Nipsey Hussle was remembered. He was an early supporter of the project. There was a fair giving out free food. There were pop-up activities like art projects. And then there were the shiny shovels at the official groundbreaking that took place at the intersection of Crenshaw Boulevard in a triangular site that is just south of Leimert Park. And the plan there is to build a rather unusual pocket park. It's going to feature a walkway that rises up from grade level to a viewing platform that's going to be 30 feet up in the air. I spoke with Zena Howard. She's the project's architect with the firm Perkins & Will.
So this is what we call Sankofa Park. And it's called Sankofa because you're actually able to turn back. It turns back on itself like the Sankofa bird, which is the Ghanaian symbol for looking back and remembering your roots as you go forward. So as you turn back and look back down the whole 1.3 Boulevard, you're also able to look forward over through the Hollywood Hills and past Leimert Park.
It's going to be quite a dramatic view. So, Sankofa Park is the first point of what are going to be 10 community gathering spaces that are going to punctuate what is a 1.3-mile-long open-air linear museum that is going to be running parallel alongside the Crenshaw LAX light rail line between Slauson and 60th Streets. And that's the area where the train is going to be running at grade.
You've been talking about this project for a while, Destination Crenshaw. We've been hearing about it. Does it really look like it's finally about to happen?
You certainly got the sense that it is.
You had the shiny shovels, right?
You had the shiny shovels. People were really, really overjoyed. I spoke with Councilman Marquis Harris-Dawson. He definitely says the project's going ahead, and this is what he had to say.
So we've raised over half the money for the project. It's a $100 million project. We've got enough money to start and finish the construction. What's left to raise is really the money for the art.
So the money is coming from public and private sources. Now, a number of local businesses were name-checked. LA Sentinel, Mothers in Action, Crenshaw Yoga, Doolin Soul Food, very well-known restaurants, Southwest Carpenter African American Task Force. But this group got the biggest shout-out.
And our main sponsor, make some noise, keep it going. You guys are fading out on me. I need you to keep the energy up. SEIU 2015.
As you can tell, one of the main points about this project is the impact it's going to have on the local economy. Here's Councilman Harris-Dawson again.
Well, the labor piece is very, very, very important because what we're working with labor and the construction industry to do is to make sure that we have a workforce that looks like the community.
Frances Anderton, you described Destination Crenshaw as this open-air museum. What about the art? So, you know, there's art in museums. What about the art for this one? What do we know about that?
The heart of this project is going to be the art, and it's going to be public art that everybody can enjoy. And we've been waiting for a while for the announcements as to who the artists will be. There's supposed to be 100 public artworks by primarily black artists. People have been wondering what's been happening, why we haven't heard more about them. Councilman Harris-Dawson, however, says the lineup's going to be announced soon. I did also meet critics of the project, and one even told me that some artists actually don't want to be involved because they're worried about being complicit in the gentrification that's happening in the neighbourhood. You can listen to Damien Goodman. He's the founder of an activist group there called the Crenshaw Subway Coalition.
Many of the artists that have backed out of the project tried to push the conversation about how do we make sure that we create greater and stronger local economy for black folk and stability for black homeowners who are at risk and renters who are terribly at risk.
This is a reference to the way that art and art galleries can push up property values. Now, I asked Councilman Harris Dawson about this and about whether artists are backing out, and he had this to say.
We haven't had anybody drop out yet. Certainly people are concerned. I mean, it's a trick, right? So you say, well, if you're a poor community, you can't have art. And if you're a wealthy community, you can. So I completely reject that argument.
Gentrification is already happening, though, in this area, Francis. I mean, we've been hearing it for a while now. We've been doing stories about it.
Yes, Steve, and absolutely. That point was made to me by another representative, actually, of Destination Crenshaw, a young man named Matthew Talley. He was running one of the pop-ups at the fair. And he said Destination Crenshaw comes partway through a process of property escalation that can be credited to the building of the Ram Stadium in Inglewood and the construction of this train line.
The Crenshaw line, yeah.
But gentrification concerns aside, the overriding feeling I certainly got from people was one of great excitement at the creation of a landmark that will celebrate black culture. Some said that this is long overdue in a region that has many neighbourhoods that give identity to a community. Just think Koreatown, Chinatown, Olvera Street. And one person who expressed a point like this was Dr. Bernice Brown. She lives in the Crenshaw District. She's been involved with the public outreach part of the Destination Crenshaw project, and here she is.
The opportunity to have a designation for African Americans in this city, which is phenomenal and a first. We've never had that opportunity before when so many other groups of people have designations in the city, and we helped found Los Angeles, and this particular area is an area that we have occupied since the 60s. I think it's very significant.
So what kind of timeline are we talking about? When are they hoping to have this open-air museum done?
The timeline's a little bit of a moving target, but definitely they're saying by next year there should be a Destination Crenshaw to go for all of us to go and enjoy.
All right. KCRW's Francis Anderton from our design and architecture desk. Francis, thanks.
You're very welcome, Steve.
All right, coming up, to tech or not to tech, how recent college grads are rethinking their futures. You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. College students look to big tech as a destination to build their career. Big tech means big money, big esteem, big opportunities. But recently, some of these big tech destinations, such as Facebook and Google, have faced some big backlash over, ironically, social and labor issues, including data privacy, workplace pay, political maneuvering. And that's led some students to reevaluate if they want to participate in that college to big tech pipeline, what some folks dub a tech lash. And those are students using their moral compass to help them determine how and where they'd like to enter the workforce. Austin Ray is a recruiter for tech startups here in Los Angeles with the firm Cadre. Austin, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Samuel Resendez is a computer science major at USC. He's finishing up his senior year over in South LA. Hey, Samuel.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You bet. I want to start with you, Samuel, because you interned at both Facebook and Google. Is that where you want to land?
It's hard to say. The landscape has definitely changed in the past couple of years, so sort of thinking about it going forward, definitely the choice and sort of the moral implications that have kind of come under scrutiny now recently has definitely made it a trickier choice for me, for sure.
A trickier, like, what has changed in your eyes in the tech industry in general?
I think sort of the cover has been pulled, right? Where now the reality of the matter is that this is an industry and there is a lot of things that are happening, both good and bad. And so I think it's important for myself especially to sort of be on the good side of that. And so weighing that in a lot of decisions that I'm making going forward is something that is becoming increasingly important for me.
Have you heard of this term called tech lash?
I haven't, no, but sort of the phenomenon I'm well aware of.
You're well aware. So talk to me about the phenomenon and what you and your classmates are saying about stuff like this.
Yeah. I mean, definitely the biggest way that I've noticed it, as someone that has worked at both Google and Facebook, is that you do sort of get a lot of ribbing coming from everyone else, is sort of this notion of selling out and having almost dubious ethics for working there. And this is something that definitely changed in the past couple of years, where coming in my freshman and sophomore year, there wasn't any of this. And now, at least culturally, there's definitely the sense that you need to justify yourself going to work at any of these companies now.
I guess, Austin Ray, as a recruiter, when people are giving you crap for working for these companies, that makes recruiting pretty hard, doesn't it?
Yeah. It's kind of difficult to shift the minds of engineers and developers in general, just because they come in with this idea of the promised land of Google and Facebook, and they kind of lose sense of what their passions truly were when they got into development, which is to make the world a better place.
But obviously something is tugging at their emotions, their moral compass, saying, wait, these companies are maybe taking part in some pretty unscrupulous things.
Yeah. I think when they started, you know, Facebook was a social platform for you to connect with your friends and family. And, you know, once they got to a point where they were ready to monetize and really make a lot of money, they decided to make some, you know, questionable decisions that didn't necessarily result in something good for the consumer.
Do you think, I mean, when you look at tech today, because everyone thought tech was going to change the world, and it surely did, and continues to change the world, right? But I think what a lot of people are discovering, and this is just my own interpretation of it, is that perhaps these are just people who want to make money, just like people during the Industrial Revolution wanted to make money, and they did so maybe not through the best of ways.
Yeah, you're exactly right. This is something that I deal with on a daily basis. I talk to developers and I ask them, you know, what do you want to do in your next role? Typically, they want to work for something mission-driven and something altruistic. And, you know, then they wind up accepting a job at Google or Facebook because they just throw a lot of money at these kids. And they're still young and impressionable in their career. And having the prestige of something recognizable that you can go and tell your friends and family, oh, I work at Facebook, or oh, I work at Google, it's much easier than saying I work for this, you know, analytics startup that's, you know, using blockchain technology. It's all just in one ear, out the other for some of your friends.
Facebook recruiters Austin told CNBC last year that it was struggling to recruit engineers fresh out of college. At some schools, 40% of students declined job offers. 40%. That's nearly half. Facebook denies this. What are you seeing on the ground?
For more junior entry-level candidates, yeah, I'm definitely seeing them, you know, gravitate towards the Facebooks and Googles, surprisingly.
Really?
Yeah, just because they have the resources, the money, and the prestige. You know, they kind of sell people on this dream of going in and, you know, learning so much and working on a product at huge scale. They're going to work with all this data, and then.
So you're seeing the opposite of what this report says.
Yeah, I'm seeing the opposite. Maybe that's just because I work with I work with startups specifically, a very specific profile of engineers. But I just think that a lot of it comes down to money and what company is going to pay them the most. I have this issue all the time with people saying they care really, you know, they hold culture very high with regard to their next job, and then. You know, we know that companies like Amazon and Google are kind of notorious for having a very cutthroat culture, yet they always wind up, you know, taking jobs there.
Samuel, is it about the money, or is it about your moral compass, or is it about most companies are like this and I'm just going to acquiesce?
It's a little bit of a mix of all of these things that a lot of us coming out ostensibly want to work for a company that is very mission-driven and has a very positive impact on the world. But simultaneously also that a lot of us very pragmatically are coming out with student loans and, you know, have to build our career professionally, right? And you have to sort of balance these two different things. Really, this whole tech lash thing has complicated the equation a lot. But I think a lot of people are still continuing to weigh in favor of sort of their professional career and making sure that they at least in the first couple of years out of college, put themselves in a good position in the industry.
I almost want to like call a psychologist right now, because this is you're like juggling all these things. And we all do this, by the way. We all come to work and we're like, is it really worth doing this, right? How much does it mean to me to go to work? How much money am I going to make? Austin, I guess, as a recruiter, you're constantly looking at people who are like, I want to make some money, and there's a lot of money to be made in this field, but I don't exactly identify with, you know, what you know, some companies are doing.
Yeah, it's really hard to find a company that you really resonate and believe in their mission and what they're doing, and also finding that company that's going to be able to support your lifestyle, that you know, the student loans, everything else. And there is a lot of psychology that goes into recruiting, and that's why our jobs will never be replaced by a computer or a machine.
but Samuel, it sounds to me like it's, you know, for you, it's like immoral versus moral and money versus no money. I mean, is there a way that you navigate that after you graduate from USC?
For myself and a lot of the people that I know that are graduating this year, that sort of is the issue that we're grappling with now.
And you know, entering the workforce, or maybe you're continuing in the workforce and you're trying to really figure out where your place is, and you just don't know, right?
Yeah. For the moment, I think there are definitely more questions than there are answers.
What are you leaning toward? If there's a company that you wanted to work for, where would it be?
It's very hard to say what I want to do long term, but I think one of the sort of added benefits of sort of this industry is that you do have a lot of room to sort of move. You know, if you don't like the team that you're on, if you're not like the company that you're at, that you're able to make that switch. And so a lot of us, I think, are also looking at sort of these things as not so much of super long term game, but also being able to sort of move independently of the company that you're associated with at any given time.
I don't want to be an enabler, Austin, but if you're recruiting Samuel down there, say you take a trip to South LA and you're like, hey, Samuel, why don't you come work for one of my companies? What would you say to him?
I'd say that in terms of your career, this is the perfect time for you to take a chance on a small company, get some equity, have a lot of ownership, and make a big impact at a startup versus just being kind of a cog in a wheel at a Facebook or a Google where you're just kind of tinkering with one thing. Have ownership of something. Join a startup.
You say equity as in you get stock options, you get those things.
Yeah.
So when the company goes from $2 a share to $500 a share,
exactly,
you're going to be able to buy that house that you want.
Exactly. It's
kind of, it's $7 million.
It's a lottery ticket. That's how we always look at equity.
Really?
You know? Yeah. I mean, it's while you're still early in your career, you can kind of afford to be a little riskier and play with that that lottery ticket and potentially have a big payout.
What about your moral compass? How do you feel about stuff like this?
You know, I personally, I enjoy working for a small team where I work collaboratively with people. I've never had an interest in working at a Google or a Facebook or an Amazon. I just think there's too much political bureaucracy, and I really like working with people who are really changing the world.
So you don't have tech lash?
No, I do not.
No tech lash for Austin. And Samuel, maybe, but I wish you both the best. Samuel, especially when you graduate at age 21. I want to thank you both. Samuel Resendez, senior in computer science over at USC. Austin Ray, recruiter with Cadre here in Los Angeles. Thanks to you both.
Thanks for having us, Steve.
Thank you so much.
All right, just ahead, tomorrow's election will feature a lot of high-profile names, obviously. But down the ballot in Orange County, there are a couple of races that haven't gotten a lot of attention. You're going to hear about them coming up on Greater LA. Back now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Tomorrow is Super Tuesday, and it aims to be super in the OC. Well, 2 years ago, Orange County turned blue when all four congressional districts held by Republicans were won by Democrats. Republicans would like those seats back. There are also a couple of not-so-high-profile but tough nonetheless contests for the Board of Supervisors. Yes, it's Monday, and Gustavo Arellano, who's doing a little field work today, is here with KCRW's Orange County Line. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
Let's take a quick look at those four congressional districts, because tomorrow is just the primary. Are any of those freshman Democrats facing any serious challenge from within their own party?
Not really. I mean, you do have some people running as the people's candidates in this era of Bernie Sanders, but Katie Porter, Gil Cisneros, Harley Ruda, Mike Levin, all those freshmen who made national news by beating longtime Republican incumbents, they're going to go easily into the general election.
But you know the Republican Party wants those seats back. Are any of those Democrats looking particularly vulnerable come November?
The big, big race is going to be in the coastal district where Harley Ruda is. He's going to be facing off against Michelle Steele, who's right now on the board of supervisors. Up in like Brea, Fullerton, Gil Cisneros, he's going to be going up against Young Kim. Now, it's interesting because if either of those Republican women win, they're going to be the first ever Korean-American women to be in Congress. In both of those districts, they're not exactly the bluest districts in Orange County. So those are going to be really, really interesting come election time in November.
I want to turn to the Board of Supervisors as advertised. Two of those five seats are up for a vote tomorrow. Democrats, for all that we're saying about the congressional seats that turned blue a couple of years ago, the Board of Supervisors is still majority Republican, right?
There's only one Democrat on the Board of Supervisors. That's going to be Doug Chafee up in North Fullerton. So the Democratic Party of Orange County has long wanted to get back into the dominance of the Board of Supervisors, which they actually used to hold way back in the 1970s.
Way back in the 70s, but here we are in 2020. There's an election in the first district currently held by Supervisor Andrew Doe, the Republican. He's up against three Democrats. Tell us a little bit about Doe, his district, and the challengers.
Andrew Doe, a Vietnamese-American politician. Before him, his predecessor was also a Vietnamese-American politician, Republican. So this has been a seat held by Vietnamese-American Republicans for over a decade at this point. And it's interesting with the Democrats because you have three generations of Democrats, three politicos. You have the baby boomer generation with Miguel Pulido, the longtime mayor of Santa Ana, who's finally termed out. He's going to have to leave City Hall after 30-some years, so he's running for supervisor. The Generation X candidate is longtime Westminster council member Sergio Contreras. And then the millennial candidate is Kimbernice Wynn. She's a councilwoman in Garden Grove. So all of them have competing visions for how they see the Board of Supervisors or what they can do on the Board of Supervisors. But meanwhile, Doe's still the favorite. So it'll be interesting to see which one of them gets to advance against Doe.
Now, that race is probably going to end up in a runoff, obviously. Do you want to make any predictions about that?
I would have to say Pulido, just because, the majority of the district is in Santa Ana, and Pulido is such a known name, even though a lot of people don't like him. It's such a known name that you know how voters get. Like, okay, we're just going to go with what's familiar. Sergio Contreras, he's a great politician, but he's in Westminster, which is, a smaller city. And Kimbernice Wynn, she's interesting because she's half Latina, half Vietnamese, very much the future of the district, but she's just too early on in the game to, I think, really make any impression on voters who are not from Garden Grove.
The other seat on the Board of Supervisors is the 3rd District. There are only two people in that race, a Republican and a Democrat. Don Wagner, the Republican, won the seat in a special election last year. He's running against Ashley Aiken, a former federal prosecutor, the Democrat in the race. Tell us a little more about that post.
Yeah, so the 3rd District, that's going to be eastern northern Orange County. So we're talking about Yorba Linda, Anaheim Hills, going all the way down Orange, Irvine, wealthier district. Now, Don Wagner, former mayor of Irvine, used to serve on the state assembly. And so he's a well-known name. Ashley Aiken, the only thing that's going for her, she's never held elected office, although she does sit on the board of trustees for the OC Fairgrounds. But what's going for her is her last name, Aiken. Her dad, Wiley Aiken, legendary figure in Orange County Democratic politics. But only the insiders of Democrats know that Aiken name. She ran for mayor for Anaheim in 2018 and lost. And so now she's going up against Wagner. And this one's a winner take all because there's no other opponents. So whoever gets over 50%, they're going to be the next supervisor.
We know who the candidates are in these races, Gustavo. What are the issues that people are talking about?
Well, right now, one of the big issues is coronavirus. We talked about last week, all these politicians, both Republicans and Democrats, uniting against the federal government and state government putting people in Costa Mesa. But really, the big issue before that is homelessness. Homelessness, housing affordability. How do you keep young people in Orange County? How do you get good jobs? I think that's going to be a bigger issue, especially for the first supervisorial district where Andrew Doe's incumbent. And then when it comes to the third one with Don Wagner and Ashley Aiken, I really think it's just standard of living, and especially since those are the more bubbly places in Orange County. How do we keep out homeless people? How do we keep out modernity from coming into our wonderland?
So not only across the country, Gustavo, but tomorrow in Orange County, it will be super as well, won't it?
Oh yeah, super.
Gustavo Arellano from the LA Times, who joins us regularly here on Greater LA. Gustavo, thanks.
Gracias.
By the way, we're going to have coverage of Election Day on the show tomorrow, including some early indicators of where the votes could go. We'll also take you to some of those voting centers. That's going to do it for us today. It's The Business with Kim Masters next. I'm Steve Chiatakis, online at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Subscribe to the podcast, won't you? Have a great day.